Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a conversation with my mother and brother as she releases a new memoir about his decision to become a Catholic priest.
And a map-making project documents the city's trees and the memories we associate with them.
But first, as the longest government shutdown in U.S. history dragged on over the last several weeks, one lawmaker was at the center of it, even though she hadn't officially been sworn in as a lawmaker yet, Adelita Grijalva. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson refused to swear her in until the government was reopened, sparking outcry from her fellow Democrats and even some Republicans. Arizona Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego got into a public spat with Johnson in the halls of the Capitol. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays threatened to sue over it, and pressure mounted. But Grijalva was not sworn in until after the government was officially reopened on November 12th.
One individual should not be able to unilaterally obstruct the swearing in of a duly elected member of Congress for political reasons.
So now that she is in office and getting to work, what is at the top of her agenda? I got a hold of Arizona's newest congresswoman yesterday to find out, beginning with one of the first official acts she took in office, visiting a remote part of the border in her district where part of the border wall is being built.
So I thought it was really important to actually go see what it was that Trump was doing through the San Rafael Valley. It's something that we've all, environmentalists, I mean, so many organizations and groups have been against the construction of the wall there because there is migration that happens there, but it's of animals and wildlife. It really has nothing to do with people because it's so remote. And the only thing happening there is construction. So I wanted to show people across the nation and definitely in CD7, like this is what Trump is doing, spending millions and millions of dollars for a completely useless border wall that is going to do nothing to fix our broken immigration system.
So obviously your father was an environmental advocate, very outspoken on these issues. You got a seat now on the House Natural Resources Committee, which he had chaired. It sounds like you want to continue his work on this front.
Absolutely do. I was very honored. My dad worked for decades on a bill called Environmental Justice for All. Mm-hmm. It's something now I'm very excited that I'll be able to work to reintroduce. Basically just requires robust consultation with tribal and other communities that stand to be impacted by mining and other projects that could hurt the environment. And it was unfortunate. One of the first things in Natural Resources Committee was, you know, trying to work around NEPA, the mm-hmm. National Environmental Policy Act, and just do everything they can to take the teeth out of that. So we had to fight against a lot of different fronts, but on that specific committee, I was really happy, and so were many tribes. I received a lot of love from all across the nation.
That's interesting.
For my role there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, any specific environmental battles in Arizona you want to highlight? I mean, we're watching, you know, mining potentially in Oak Flat near the Grand Canyon as well. There's the border wall you mentioned. There's issues of public lands. There's, you know, springs that are drying up, water rights issues. What are you watching first?
Literally all of the above. Oak Flat, protecting Oak Flat is very important, even though it's technically not in my district. It's so adjacent and will have a real impact throughout the district. Mm-hmm. And also Patagonia and the mining project there.
Yeah,
I mean, really, it has to do with a lot of mining and the fact that, you know, we have many examples throughout Arizona of what mining has done to devastate our environment, to leave cancer clusters, to pollute our air and water and land. And so minimally, we have to work to update that mining law, but protect those areas right now.
The border wall is an environmental issue that you were highlighting, but it's also, you know, a symbol of immigration. And that's such a hot button topic right now. We've seen the Trump administration going into U.S. cities and conducting raids, arresting and deporting and detaining people in immigrant communities, a lot of fear in immigrant communities. What are you seeing in your district? What are you hearing from folks?
Literally, I just had a meeting with the mayor of Tucson where we were talking about, you know, what are the scenarios that happen if Trump sends more ICE agents into our area? When you look at what has happened this year with militarizing ICE, allowing them to target our immigrant communities, to be able to scapegoat us. If we look a certain way, we talk a certain way, we have, you know, a labor kind of job that we can be pulled over for any reason. And the fact that the courts are not protecting people, our communities have to do, are put in that position where we have to do more of that. We've seen that across the nation, and we're worried about it here.
So I want to ask you, I mean, all of these issues are important, but it seems that the politically expedient issue right now for Democrats has got to be affordability, right? I wonder, like, what do you think lawmakers can do to affect this issue, to bring down prices? Like, is this out of the control of government policy, or do you think there are concrete things that, you know, you will be talking about as Democrats to try to bring the issue of affordability home?
I mean, the biggest issue right now is tariffs. And that is something that's apparently just the discretion, sole discretion of Trump. So when we look at that kind of cost, it's an increase that definitely impacts our pocketbooks. Systemically, there's absolutely policy that can help working people. When we don't target things like affordable housing, when we don't target things like our public education system, when we're not looking at how much it's costing day after day, without an increase in, you know, the minimum wage. I mean, those are things that we have complete control over in Congress and can work to improve in policy. We see it at the local level, but there are so many ways that the federal system is hurting people. And when you look at the kind of cuts that this administration has done on programs that actually help the most vulnerable in our communities, that's where we're going to see an increase in unhoused populations, small families, single parents that are going to be out on the street because the program that they were involved in is no longer there. Yeah. Or the workforce development grants that have all been cut from our community colleges. Mm-hmm. I mean, those direct impacts, you can feel them in our communities. And, you know, when they say, well, we're doing what we can to cut taxes. Right. But you're balancing that those cuts on the backs of working people every single time.
Okay, so let me ask you lastly, Congresswoman, I mean, given what happened here with your very delayed swearing in to your seat in Congress, will you be exploring changes to House procedure to kind of prevent that from happening again?
Absolutely. And there has to be some nonpartisan support to ensure that that doesn't happen again. Because when you think about that, 50 days broke a record. But now that it's been broken, the next time when they wait 65 or 70, it might not be that big of a deal. Mm. But policy-wise, at the D.C. level, but here locally, we're in a conference room right now in D.C., waiting for our internet and our phones to be turned on. We just signed a lease last week because all of the services here locally, we haven't been able to roll out. But the need has continued to increase. So just from the date I was sworn in today, we have 45 cases that need constituent services. Our constituent services team just received their government email last Friday. So there are logistical holdups that are hurting the constituents that are here in district. So we have to make sure that this never happens again to another person.
So let me ask you one more big picture question here, because of this delay, right, because of this kind of back and forth and the government shutdown and your role in that, your name has become, you know, much more well known probably than it might have been if you were just sworn in as usual, right, as one of many, many Congress people in Washington. What do you want to do with this moment in the spotlight? Do you see it that way, like as this kind of unusual chance that you get to really speak out and maybe, you know, lots of people for a minute here will hear what you have to say?
Yeah, I think what I really want to do is focus on the issues that Southern Arizona sent me to Congress to fight for. Our little big district over here in Arizona is actually a microcosm, I think, of the nation. We have urban areas, rural areas, we have farming issues, water issues, environment issues, immigration, affordability, and really protecting our democracy. So any opportunity that I have to amplify and get more services to Southern Arizona, I'm going to. And I'm going to continue to talk about the issues that people elected me and voted for me to fight for. And I believe that they're resonating really well in general with the American people.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva joining us. Thank you so much. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
When is the last time you really looked at a map? Many of us have come to associate maps with apps on our phones that we use to get from point A to point B. But our next guest thinks of maps as opportunities for deep reflection. Jen Urso is an artist here in Phoenix, and she's just launched a new map-making project called Treasured Trees. It's a collaboration with the city's Office of Heat Response and Mitigation. Urso wants Phoenicians to send her stories about their favorite trees, which she will then incorporate into a hand-drawn map illustrating the role trees play in urban life. As Urso told me recently, part of the inspiration for this project came from her own curiosity about a tree in her neighborhood.
I walk to meet my son to pick him up from school, and it's like we're choosing a route based on like where can we find the best shade, and it's always like a huge challenge. So there's this one really gorgeous old olive tree in my neighborhood. I know that the history of olive trees here in the city is they've stopped planting fruiting olive trees. And I don't know, I think they said it was something to do with like allergies or whatever, which I just find really funny that we would plant a tree and make it like not do what it would naturally do. But, you know, olive trees are just so, I don't know, they feel like really like legendary, and they're sort of twisted and gnarled and, you know, and dense. Mm-hmm. And it's just like I would walk by it all the time and just be like, wow, this is like the coolest looking tree, you know, even though knowing too it's not like a native tree. It's not, right. You know, so I feel a little guilty because I like it so much.
That's so interesting, though. I mean, I associate to the idea of kind of ancientness when I think of olive trees. It makes me think of Greece, you know.
Yeah.
And there is sort of an interesting Phoenix commentary there that here we are in this ancient, ancient land, but so many things here are so new. Mm-hmm. And here we are transplanting this type of tree here.
Yeah, mostly new because we, you know, sort of bulldozed over and covered up a lot of the past. But it's there for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So once you get to a critical mass of stories, whatever that means, what will you do next?
What I'm going to do is take a few select stories and create augmented reality experiences about them. So these will be things that people can access through like a QR code, either on this map that I'm going to make or a website. But it'll be sort of just like a celebration of trees in the city, which I feel like will help emerge them from where they are, because like they exist. You just, you know, a lot of us just don't know maybe where they are because we're on the freeway. But once you get into the neighborhoods, you know, there's always something kind of interesting to find, and, you know, really interested in hearing about, you know, I don't know, like, did your grandparent plant this tree or did you collect beans from the mesquite? Like, what's your story with it, you know?
I could also imagine in a place like Phoenix where a tree is less of a common sighting than it is in other cities, that narrative relationship that you're describing, your grandparent planted it, whatever the case may be, the relationship to the story of that tree for an individual person being a little bit deeper perhaps and more significant than it would be in some hypothetical other place.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, 'cause like being from the Philadelphia area, like it's just trees everywhere.
Right.
And you don't really differentiate this tree from that tree as much because it's just a big forest.
Right.
You know, and also, I think, you know, trees have such a like a nursing kind of role here in the desert. So, you know, you have like the ironwoods and the mesquites, all of these that are legumes, you know, so they fix nitrogen in the soil. They cause like plants to grow around the base. But also, if you let like mesquites and palovertes kind of grow their natural canopy, they create like a home. It's almost like a tent around the soil so that other kinds of living things can survive, you know, in the desert. So they just have such an interesting role as like an isolated thing.
Can I ask what it's been like for you as map maker? You've done a project
sort of like this previously with cacti. Mm-hmm. How did that change for you, your experience of moving around the city, seeing various species of cacti?
Whenever you're going anywhere and your focus is on something specific, like if you're looking for, let's say, thrift stores, or you're looking for a gas station, yeah. you know, like that's all you're tuned in to see.
Yeah.
So I think it's the same. You can shift that. And I wanted to shift it when I worked on the cactus map to think about our city through a different kind of lens, like through a different focal point.
Yeah.
Because those things are just as rich in what make our environment, and also what makes Phoenix like quite unique compared to a lot of other cities.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and I think maybe Phoenix is doing a little bit better now about letting the desert emerge in its way, but it could do way better. You know, I feel like Tucson has a really good handle on this. You know, just seeing what is this natural landscape? It's not barren.
There is a real overlap in terms of all these projects of yours that we've been discussing, in terms of the larger goal, it seems to me, of making the invisible stakes of a place really palpable.
Well, and I think it's even more than, let's say, a place. It's what, you know, the make visible or make known other aspects. And this has been something that I've realized I pursue as an artist in general, like what the tying thread is between all my work has been this kind of, all right, well, we're not talking about this. Let's talk about it. You know, I've done that with grief and with, you know, misogyny and with the botanical and like with dirt and vacant lots and all kinds of stuff that it seems like, well, these are really integral, important components of our lives that we don't give enough credit to because we're sort of perpetually being dazzled by the spectacular. And I've always sort of resisted the spectacular. Like whenever a big blockbuster movie comes out, I'm like, I don't want to go see that. Like I like resist. You tell me it's popular, I don't want to do that, you know. And that's probably like not also not like the best attitude. But
it's interesting though.
Yeah, but I will say like with Jurassic Park, like when I finally did see it, like 20 years later, I was like, this is so terrible. Like all it is, this whole movie is just people running away from dinosaurs. Like that's it, you know.
Well, also, if I may, Jen, your work is about like moving towards things. If you just take one tree as a story, there's the story that one individual person might have with that tree that's in their front yard, say. But then there's also the story of the lineage and the legacy of that particular species of tree and all the life that it's enabling through the shade that it creates. And
yeah, and the relationship we have with it. And I really am just so fascinated with these little bits of people's lives, like how we keep going on and how we keep finding interest in things. And it's not the big stuff. You know, it's like little moments of pause. It's, you know, watching our children play, or it's, you know, having like noticing a butterfly. I mean, it kind of sounds a little woo-woo and trivial, but I feel like, you know, that's the stuff that kind of makes life worth living and continuing. Like you wake up and you're like, I don't know, should I do today? And it's like, you know, and then you hear the rain falling outside and you have like a moment of kind of peace that there's something else happening. You know, yes, this is a map about trees, but for me, it's about connecting with these like little stories and reminding people to see how important those things are, you know, and celebrate them.
Well, Jen Urso is an artist and a map maker. Jen, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
If you would like to send Jen Urso a tree story of your own, visit her website at steadyhandmaps.com. And you're listening to the show.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, is it unconstitutional to police the behavior of college football fans?
But first, it is Thanksgiving week here on the show, and that means a lot of us are getting ready to spend some quality time with our families. And so now I'd like to introduce you to some of my family. I am joined in studio now by my mother, Kristen Grady Gilger, and my big brother, Father Patrick Gilger. Now, two things here. One, you heard right. I referred to my brother there as Father. He is a priest, a Jesuit priest. That's what I usually tell folks as the social justice-y, education-focused Catholics. Pope Francis was, once upon a time, a Jesuit. And two, yes, it is weird for me to have my family in studio with me here, but they are here for a good reason. My mom has just come out with a book about my brother and his unlikely journey to become a priest. It's called My Son, the Priest, A Mother's Crisis of Faith. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore tonight in Phoenix to talk more about it. And as I'm sure he will tell you, it is more a book about her than about him, but we'll get to all of that soon enough. Patrick is also a professor, as Jesuits often are. He teaches sociology at Loyola University of Chicago and is a sought-after spiritual director. He got his PhD in sociology at the New School in New York, a liberal enclave where he was most certainly the only celibate Catholic, let alone the only priest. My mother, Kristen, spent her career as a journalist, moving us around the country as she worked her way up in newsrooms. We moved here when I was in middle school because she took a job as deputy managing editor of the Arizona Republic. She retired last year after 16 years at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at ASU, and now she has time to do things like take care of my kids and write this book. Mom, Patrick, thanks for being here.
It's nice to be here.
I'm very happy to be here with you.
Okay, so let's talk about this book. It's about our family, it's about religion and faith and much more. But Mom, you basically, you wrote this book because you did not understand this decision that Patrick made to become a priest, and you wanted to understand it. You're a true journalist in this way. You wanted to get an in on it in this way. So let's start with a little bit about us, about the family, about why it was unlikely there, as I referred to it, that Patrick became a priest. I mean, aren't mothers supposed to be excited when their priests, when their son become priests, right? This is a good thing?
Yeah, I think so. But I think I'm a fairly unlikely mother of a priest. You know, just being a journalist, a fallen away Catholic, a skeptic, a cynic, someone who likes to count things and have them explained. And I was raised Catholic and baptized my kids Catholic, but eventually left the church. Mm-hmm. Largely because I just didn't agree with a lot of things that were going on and stands on some social issues. Feminism was a big part of it. We raised you Episcopalian. We didn't even raise you Catholic. So how did this happen?
That's exactly right. So, yes, talk more about that. There's this story we always tell in our family about this kind of dramatic moment when you decided to leave the Catholic Church when we were kids. Probably the second time you left the church. But start there for us. Tell us that story.
Yeah, second time, actually. So this was shortly after Patrick had just received his first communion. And he was insistent we had to go to church on Sunday. So we go to church one Sunday, and it was the day where the priest is asking you to pledge money for the church. And they hand out these little cards, and the priest says, "Now, I only want the men in the family to fill out these cards because the men are responsible for the finances." Ooh. And I'm sitting there, and I'm just outraged, completely outraged, right? And so I took a pen and every inch of space on that card, I wrote exactly what I thought of what he had said and kind of pulled Patrick out of the church with me. He had no idea what was going on. And I handed the card to the priest and I said, "And I'm not coming back." And that was the last time that I went back for a long time.
A very long time. Let's talk about the other time you left the church, which was when you were younger. You write a lot about your family, this big Irish Catholic family, in the book, about, you know, being one of eight kids and not having enough money and the impact of alcoholism on your family. How did that impact your view of Catholicism? Like, you left the church the first time kind of with all of this tied up together.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I was raised Catholic. I have good experiences with the Catholic Church. You know, I remember, you know, the pastor and the assistant pastor of our local parish coming over on Friday nights and playing cards and drinking a lot of Jim Beam with my parents, you know, and and being very active in the church and the Catholic Youth Organization, playing softball. You know, I had a lot of good memories of the church. But as I, you know, got through middle school and high school, the drinking began to overwhelm my family. Mm. And both my parents were alcoholics. And it got so bad that I felt like I had to leave. And so the minute I graduated from high school, you know, I moved out. Mm. And to me, Catholicism was so tied up with my family that kind of leaving my family meant leaving the Catholic Church as well. It all seemed entwined to me, part of the same thing.
Yeah.
So letting go of one meant letting go of the other.
Yeah. So let's fast forward to Patrick being a 17-year-old freshman in college and you sort of insisting on him going to Creighton University, sort of in a way you didn't understand at the time. This was kind of a Catholic Jesuit university in Omaha, where you're from, near your family. And I want to turn to you here, Patrick, because you went to Creighton to become a doctor. You had always said you wanted to be a doctor. I remember this. You were in love with your girlfriend from high school at the time, madly, and you end up 4 years later, like graduating as a 21-year-old who wants to become a priest and be celibate the rest of your life. Like, how did this happen?
You know, I think I've spent most of my life trying to answer that question, how did this happen? And I still don't have a great answer to it, you know. But, you know, lots of things happened to us in college. For me, I think the short version is that I got to Creighton and I had never met people, human beings, who kind of combined what the Jesuits combined for me, this intellectual rigor and interest in the world without fear, with a willingness to sacrifice themselves for people who were on the margins, and a normalcy. Like, these are people who you could like have a beer and talk about the NBA with, and then at the same time, then bring up Jesus. And maybe I can say it this way, like, for a long time in my life, hearing the word Jesus, I just kind of felt, okay, that's a little weird, you know, like I just didn't ring right. And meeting Jesuits, it was the first time I had met people who could say the name Jesus and it didn't weird me out. And mm-hmm. I was like, wow, like what's going on here? And then combining that with this philosophical rigor and et cetera, as I said, there was something that just captured my heart. But even saying all those things, which are true, I don't know the answer to that question.
There's no good answer to that question.
I remember very well when you called home and said, I'm changing my major from pre-med to philosophy. Oh. And I said, philosophy? What are you going to do with a degree in philosophy?
That's a very legitimate question. But you had, Mom, really pushed him to go to Creighton. Yeah. And there's this scene in the book where I remember this. Like, I was probably in high school, and Patrick comes home with the Jesuit recruiter from Creighton. And they come to the house, they have dinner, and he asks you and Dad at some point, like, if you were surprised that Patrick was considering entering the priesthood. And you both answered right away, but had different answers.
Right. I remember this well. So he asked, you know, does your son's interest in becoming a Jesuit priest surprise you? And my husband said yes, and I said no at the exact same moment.
Right.
And we kind of just looked at each other. And I don't know where the no came from, but I think that somewhere inside me, I don't know. I kind of just, it didn't surprise me. Like I saw this coming in many ways. And when I look back, mm-hmm. you know, on things that had happened in his life and our lives, it made sense to me in retrospect in a way that it didn't when it was happening.
Yeah. Yeah. As so many things often do. There was one moment, and we only have maybe 30 seconds left here before we're going to go to a quick break, but one moment at his baptism, right, that came up here.
Yeah, so when he was baptized, we were at my sister's parish church, and it was a cloudy day, no hint of sun. And just as the priest pours the water over his head, you know, this shaft of light shines down right on the baby, you know, and we all went, ooh. And I remember the priest said, God has something very special in mind for this child. And at the time, we sort of shrugged it off, like, oh, nice, you know, nice touch, a ray of sun. Hmm. But looking back, that seems significant to me.
Yeah, yeah, coming from a skeptical person. All right, so this is my mother and brother, Kristen Grady Gilger, and Father Patrick Gilger. They'll both be at Changing Hands Bookstore tonight. The book is My Son, the Priest. We'll be back to continue this conversation after the break.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Let's return now to my conversation with my mother, Christian Grady Gilger, and my brother, Patrick Gilger, the subject of my mom's new book, My Son, the Priest. Okay, so Patrick, let's turn to you now and talk about the Jesuits a little bit, about what drew you to them. Mom writes about this in the book, but I mean, you didn't just want to become a priest. You wanted to become a Jesuit in particular. What was it about them in particular that you were drawn to, and not just the fact that apparently the Jedis were based on them?
Whether that's true or not true, I'm not sure I can confirm, but as our grandfather used to say, sometimes the story is better than the truth. So. you know, I wish I knew perfectly what it was that the Jesuits did for me. But I remember like walking into a professor's office, a Jesuit professor's office at Creighton University, where I went to undergraduate. And all around the walls were all of these books, like, you know, secular books like Nietzsche and Karl Marx and all these things. And then there were these crosses on the walls. And then there was this like normal guy sitting across from me. It was like, how's your life? How's the dorm going? Like, what's your family like? And having somebody who could kind of answer and ask all of those different kinds of questions and share those kinds of things, there was something that was really magnetic about me. I had never really, like, you know, I'm an extremist. Yeah. And like, I want everything. I want everything. And so the idea that there were these people who could be relatively normal, immersed in the world, interested in everyday life, and give everything for something that was worth our lives, worth my life, that combination just absolutely captivated me. And I'm still trying to, you know, live that out 20-something years later.
Mom, you were not surprised that the Jesuits in particular attracted him, right? This kind of elite group in this way.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I thought that, well, if he has to become a Catholic priest, this is probably the best option. So, I mean, for the book, I did a lot of research on the Jesuits because, frankly, I didn't know anything about them. I knew Creighton was a Jesuit university, but I really didn't know anything about the Jesuits. So I researched a lot of write a chapter about the history of the Jesuits, and they're fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think that their commitment to, you know, an intellectual rigor, as Patrick put it, their spiritualism, their connection and their involvement in the real world. It can be hard to spot a Jesuit because they're often not wearing the collar, right?
I made him wear it today, but yep.
I mean, they live in the real world, and then their commitment to social justice, to, I mean, listening to Pope Leo and his stance on immigration and how immigrants are being treated. These things resonate strongly with me. So those are all positives.
The Jesuits have been controversial too, right, Patrick? Like in terms of modern day issues like LGBTQ plus Catholics, but also, you know, historically liberation theology is kind of rooted in the Jesuits.
Yeah. I mean, those things emerge from our effort to think with the church in the midst of real people's lives. So for example, with liberation theology, all that meant was spending real time with people who are living in rural situations in Latin America or in the barrios, or people's actual crises that they're facing, and then trying to think about what the meaning of the incarnation or the Trinity might be from there. And what it means is what God wants for human beings is the fullness of life, freedom, hope, joy, relationships, the same things that we all want. And then the question becomes, how do we build a society that can help these kinds of things be real, help what God wants actually happen?
Yeah. I always tell people to try to explain you easily and quickly that you've been arrested many times at many protests.
Yes, I can't deny that.
Okay, so we have to talk about these vows that you take, though, as a priest. I think most people will be aware of that, right? That you commit yourself when you become a priest to three things: poverty, chastity, and obedience. Patrick, what do these things mean?
Yeah, you know, I think when most people think about those three words, mostly what they hear is like a giant red stop sign, like, yep, like a negative, you know, don't do these things. And that's true. There are things that you give up there. So for me, poverty means I don't actually own anything. Like the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, give me everything I have.
And you can't inherit anything from us.
That's right. And with regard to obedience, like, I did not choose to get a PhD. I was sent. I was missioned to do this. And I didn't choose where I was going to work. Like, I had to apply to Loyola University in Chicago like everybody else does. But I was sent there to apply there. And with regard to chastity, like, no, I have to say no to, you know, sexual relationships and marriage commitments and to families, all that kind of thing that I would have loved to have. But the no is really just an avenue for another yes. Hmm. Like, I didn't really see those things as like a big ban on my life. Like, they were a way that I could get the thing that I wanted. Like, my heart was set alive with this idea of giving my life away this way. And so if I had to, you know, say no to XYZ, which are important things, good things, especially families and love and freedom, those are good things. But if I had to say no to some of that to do this thing that I was falling in love with, fine.
This, however, was not as easy or as obvious as a thing for your mother, right? I think one of the hardest parts for you, and you really write about this a lot in the book, is that you were worried that, you know, Patrick will never get married, he'll never have kids, he'll die alone in like a Jesuit priest retirement home with no grandchildren to visit him. I mean, are you still worried about that?
Well, not as much as I used to be. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book, was to sort of work through, you know, yeah, these concerns and these issues. But, you know, I mean, a big concern for me was grandkids. I've always made it very clear that I expected lots of grandchildren from my three children.
You're welcome.
But
that's,
yeah,
right,
yeah. You've stepped up. You and your sister, between you, I have five grandchildren now, which pretty much lets Patrick off the hook, although more would always be welcome. And I did worry about loneliness. You know, I thought, you know, what happens when you, you know, when you age and you have no family, immediate family around you, although he'll always have, you know, his sisters.
Yeah.
And I actually talked to a Jesuit priest at Brophy at St. Francis about this, and he laughed. You know, he said that, he said a couple of things that I think were significant. One, that everybody's lonely sometimes. You know, getting married and having children actually is not an antidote to loneliness.
Yeah.
And that he really isn't lonely, surrounded by a really very large family. I think I realized that when Patrick was ordained. I mean, hundreds of people showed up. Mm-hmm. You know, they came from the Pine Ridge Reservation. They came from New York. They came from all over the country. All these people who I didn't know, who all feel like he has a very special place in their lives. So I don't worry about that as much anymore.
But the concern, like the central thing there, is that you want your kids to be happy, right? And you were worried this would not fundamentally make him happy. But I remember you two having this argument once, and Patrick basically saying, like,
we never argue, come on.
Only occasionally.
I think this was over cards, right? Like, and you said, like, basically, it's not about being happy.
Yeah, no, I think happiness is, of course, deeply important in life, but it's not as important as joy or fulfillment or purpose. Like, basically what I think, like, I'm a Catholic. Like, what is the meaning of life? The meaning of life for me is self-sacrificial love. And we have all kinds of choices with regard to how we're going to live out a version of self-sacrificial love in our lives. Like, we all do it in different ways. Mom, you and Dad did that by family, but so do you, Lauren. Like, you do it in your own ways. Like, you guys all live out this image of self-sacrificial love. So I had a choice as to how I was going to live it out, but not whether I was. Hmm. I just had to give my life away in one way or another. And happiness comes after that gift of self-sacrifice, not just beforehand. It doesn't come by avoiding it. It comes by going through it.
Yeah. Okay, so last minute here, Mom, and I want to go back to the point we made at the beginning, which is why you wrote this book, right? To understand this life that your son chose that you could just not understand at all. So the book is out. You've done it. You've written it. Do you think you understand it now?
I think so. I mean, this has been a journey for me as well, a spiritual journey for me, you know, to think back on my own relationship with God and with the Catholic Church. And I, you know, I am not like a believer in everything, but I'm a Catholic. And, you know, I go to church and I try to pray and to live my life in a way that I don't know, I guess that my children can be proud of, that I can be proud
of.
Very
proud.
I think, you know, the book was a way for us to have conversations, lots of conversations, and to understand each other and to sort of bridge that gap between my very secular world and his religious world.
Yeah.
And I think it's done that.
I think it's done that. All right. Well, that is my mother and my brother, Kristen Grady Gilger, and father, Patrick Gilger. They will both be at Changing Hands Bookstore tonight in Phoenix to talk more about her new book, My Son the Priest. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. The University of Arizona will visit ASU on Friday for the annual Territorial Cup football game. Many college stadiums have signs or announcements about fan behavior, things fans cannot say or do, and what will happen if they do them. But our next guest argues those rules may be unconstitutional. Neil Ternus is an assistant professor of sports management at Northern Illinois University, where he researches sport and spectator experiences at colleges and universities with a focus on the First Amendment. He and a colleague analyzed every FBS college athletic department's posted stadium speech policies. They found more than 90% of the public colleges and universities that posted restrictions on what fans can wear, do, or say at games had rules that violated the principles of the First Amendment, and that includes schools in Arizona. But Ternus says he doesn't think athletic departments are necessarily acting maliciously with these policies. Ternus spoke with our co-host, Mark Brody, more about this, and they started with those findings and what they mean.
I think the way I would phrase that is that their policies as written are not compliant with the First Amendment. I think one of the barriers, and one thing I really want to emphasize with this research compared to praxis, what's going on in the field, is we specifically measured the wording and the text of what's going on in their policies. We still are looking at and are continuing to research questions of enforcement. So it's the difference between the rules as written and the rules as applied. So I want to be careful to say that the rules as written do not work with the First Amendment. We're still looking into the rules as applied.
So there might be an issue where, for example, a stadium says you cannot say this kind of thing, but what happens to a fan if they do say that kind of thing?
Typically, if a fan is caught violating these policies, a lot of times they will be escorted out of the stadium and asked to leave. In a lot of these policies, there is explicit language that their ticket privileges may be revoked and they're not allowed to purchase tickets through the athletic department again, which can make it a little bit more difficult and challenging for them to access future athletic events. Depending on other behavior, if they are complicit in other types of illegal behavior, such as public intoxication, they can also face charges for that as well.
Well, so what is so problematic about these policies? What are schools saying that fans can't do that maybe they should be allowed to be able to do?
They're really problematic in two different ways. First, they are very specific in what they ban. And second, they are very vague in many cases. And I realize that sounds contradictory.
Yeah.
But when you look at the text of those policies, sometimes they're banning language that is very specific. So I'll throw out a couple examples local to you. So the University of Arizona has a policy, and I'm going to read it directly off here, that says behavior and language based on race, color, national origin, sex, religion, age, disability, veteran status, sexual orientation, gender expression, or gender identity can have you removed from an Arizona athletic event. Now, that's a very specific list, but the problem is it says all behavior and language based on those things. We look at this as, well, I am myself a white man with German ancestry. If I go to an Arizona athletic event and buy a soft pretzel, am I expressing my national origin, its behavior and language based in that? Does that get me ejected? And it's confusingly written in such a way where it really applies to everything and nothing at the same time. And that might seem like an absurd example, but the thing that we've gone back to and the example we've come back to is if I were to show up at one of these events with a sign that said trans lives matter or the opposite political view, only women belong in women's sports or something of that nature, do I get kicked out? And does one of those get kicked out and not the other? And this doesn't specify that. And that's a real problem because it puts a lot of judgment calls on the shoulders of stadium officials. And the Supreme Court and the U.S. court system has been very uniform, and those types of judgment calls are what we call overbroad. They give way too much power to government entities to make decisions about what speech is acceptable and what's not.
Well, so what would be a better way to do that? Because there's obviously been so much conversation, you know, in the last weeks and months about the First Amendment and, you know, what is acceptable speech and what is maybe not acceptable, what is okay but maybe in bad taste. So how should schools be going about trying to create an environment where fans feel welcome and fans feel like they can express themselves, but also maintaining, you know, everybody's First Amendment rights?
There are a couple things, especially now that we think this is a great opportunity. And when we were writing this paper much earlier this year, we certainly weren't anticipating the current political climate. that has sort of manifested over the last few months. But what we would see as the relevant motions or what needs to be done for athletic departments is focusing back to first principles. How do we actually want these stadium atmospheres to work? And how do we write policies that make sense when we think about not just a general commitment to the First Amendment, but the extremely important role that the First Amendment plays on colleges and university campuses? The First Amendment is essential to so much of what we do on college and university campuses, and the sports stadiums that we have are often the most public forums where people get a chance to interact with our colleges and universities. When it comes to writing policy to that point, we really look at actually following the language of local and federal law when possible. A lot of the behavior that, especially my colleague Manya and I talk about quite a bit, that we want to make sure that we're not saying, hey, this is okay, is language that could be construed as harassment. If you imagine going to a basketball game at Arizona or Arizona State, and someone is sitting courtside and continues to get in the ear of a ref or a player, and we've had some pretty horrific examples of that. That type of behavior, harassment, is illegal. But we also need to see, like, where is the line on harassment and what kind of behavior constitutes harassment? Certainly the fan who is repeatedly targeting a single player or a single official or another coach about that is harassing that person. Someone who's sitting back in row 50 in the cheap seats and the nosebleeds, who they can't even hear them, the harassment has to be received. So that is a distinction there that needs to be made. And I think as a whole, college athletic departments could do a much better job of narrowly tailoring their policies to prohibit the kind of behavior they're actually looking to prohibit, which is harassing behavior, and behavior that is really meant to disrupt, to psychologically disrupt and harm people, rather than trying to target a much wider swath of behavior that ends up, as we found, potentially limiting political speech, potentially limiting just the general conversation that happens during any sporting event.
So you referenced what the U of A's policy is. Is it safe to say that ASU's policy is somewhat similar to what Arizona's is?
ASU's is similar, but a little bit different. ASU's, and I have it pulled up right here so we can talk about it straight away. The first line, and they have a bullet pointed list on things that are prohibited, is wearing clothing deemed obscene, indecent, and or offensive. Obscene has a very specific legal term in First Amendment law, but indecent or offensive are very subjective standards. And again, this goes back to, it puts a lot of the onus on stadium officials to decide what is indecent or offensive and what can we kick out and what can we not kick out. And that simply is an amount of power that the government says you should not have in that situation. Moreover, it goes on to say any threatening, vulgar, abusive, racist, sexist, or demeaning marks or gestured. The better part of that is it's directed towards coaches, so there is that element of harassment there. They also talk about threats, which they can limit and they can seize actionable. But one thing that we've noticed a lot is some of the way these are written, especially when they aren't necessarily as targeted as saying they're directed towards a specific person or they're directed towards a specific group that are employees of the institution, they might not be as enforceable as harassment as a case where someone's yelling those types of comments to an official or a coach or even a player.
Hmm. All right. That is Neil Ternus, Assistant Professor of Sport Management at Northern Illinois University. Neil, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mark.
All right. Well, that will do it for today's installment of The Shore. The Shore? The Show.
The Shore Show.
Yes. I hope the show made you feel like you were relaxing on the shore. We'll be back here again tomorrow morning. Hope you will join us then. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show.